Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Welcome to Living Free Show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 kilohertz on your AM dial. I'm Anne, and along with Michael, my co-host today, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present, and to acknowledge that the material and spiritual connection of Aboriginal people to this land was stolen from them. Each week on the Living Free Show, we showcase one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drug, alcohol, gambling, food, and other addictions. Our guests share their recovery stories and highlight that shared experience saves lives. Before we start, I'd like to remind you that the Living Free Show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm, and family violence. Please practice self-care and care of others when listening. Today in the studio, we're joined by Brian. Brian is a member of both AA and Al-Anon, and we'll touch on both of those programs, I think, as Brian tells his story of addiction to alcohol and also of being affected by being close to someone with a problem of alcohol. So welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
And welcome, Michael.
Yeah, thanks for having me here.
Okay, so Michael will be the special comments man today, and Brian will be the main attraction. So, Brian, would you like to just start us off, please, by telling us where you grew up?
I grew up in the suburb of Burwood on the other side of town from where we are here in Fitzroy. And my dad died when I was 3 and a half, and there were about 9 male role models in my life that were mainly interested in my mum rather than myself. And when I was 12, my mum remarried, and she remarried a guy that was a teacher of the deaf, and he taught in a regional school but was located in Ballarat. So all of my youth was spent in Ballarat. And then I came back to Melbourne for work.
Mm-hmm. And what was the what would you say your childhood was like, you know, in terms of having the single mother and having, it sounds like, different male role models coming in and out of your life? Did that have an impact on you?
Well, I had a fantasy about the sort of dad that I would like, and could never get close to that. And then when my mum remarried my stepdad, he didn't fit that fantasy role, mm-hmm. you know. And that's okay, because he offered me a lot more than what I took up on. You know, uh-huh. And my life up until that time and beyond that was, in one word, uncomfortable. So my mum was, I experienced her as very controlling, and when I jump, it has, you know, on the way up, ask how high and all of that sort of stuff, enmeshed with this is the way we behave and this is what we know in society. And the other part of my relationship with my mum is I call myself the little husband. So there are expectations put on me that were way, way, way ahead of where I was in life.
What did that look like, Brian? What did it look like to be the little husband? What sort of expectations?
Well, it's normal because you don't know anything else.
Yeah, but what did your mum, was she using you as a confidant? Was she telling you all her problems? Or?
Yes, it was that. And then we paint the cupboard this way, and, oh, look, you've mucked it up, or stuff like that. Or there were times that I was punished and I was put in my room for long periods of time, like days. And for such a young kid, it plays around with your thinking and your mind when that sort of thing happens. And, that'll probably explain it enough. That was a lot more serious than what I explained, but that'll do.
Yeah.
Was your mum a drinker?
My mum was not a drinker, a teetotaler. Wow. Oh, no, she'd have one drink socially. So when she was out, Michael, in society, every hair was in place, her dress was immaculate, and in a way she demanded the respect of the public, but was a completely different figure at home, under a lot of stress and a widower receiving a very modest, benefit from the government and stuff like that. So,
are you aware of any alcohol in her background? I often think when people are teetotalers, there might be some story there about why they're. Hmm.
She put on her 50th wedding anniversary when I was 10, and her brother appeared, who I craved for relatives to be. In my life as a male role model, and he was I think he ran a casino up in New South Wales and was a drinker and had a ruddish complexion, and I think he was also a gambler, and so there is a possibility of that. But I never got close enough to him to know, because he went straight back to New South Wales after that and really had nothing to do with my grandparents, his parents.
Mm-hmm. Mm. What about your school years? Was there difficulty there for you at school? You said you felt uncomfortable in yourself. Is that right? Is that what you said? You sort of felt uncomfortable?
Well, when someone like myself and... It wouldn't be an uncommon experience, goes to school, it's called freedom, but you don't blend in with what's going on at school. You're just after the freedom and dodge around any rules that are there. So when you like that, you'll succeed in subjects that you're interested in, and otherwise you won't. And that was my experience.
Mm-hmm. And... when was your first experience of alcohol as a...
At the 50th wedding anniversary, there was a bowl of punch on top of a sideboard, which was about up to the top of my head, and Mum pointed at it and said, "Don't touch that, it's got alcohol in it." And she left the room, a chair went straight over the sideboard, and I was into it. Had one glass. I can remember it hitting my gut right to this day, and the warm glow.
How old were you?
10.
You bet.
And so from that first drink, you went, "This is good."
No, I'd made up my mind to drink because of the social environment that existed in Australia at that time. So the stats on it in those days, that 10% of the population was alcoholic. That has changed now, and it's 7%, which is a really good thing. So, I just saw all the guys that were drinking, and I thought, wow, that this is good, because as soon as someone has a drink, they start to relax and let loose, and I, with my upbringing, could fit into that a lot better,
So we're talking teenage years now, like going to parties and...
Say it again.
We're talking at your teenage years now. As you came into your young manhood, were you thinking, "That's how I'm going to be a man, I'm going to be drinking with all the guys"?
Yes, that's right. Mm. Yeah.
And tell me, was that drinking, was it problematic from the beginning?
No. No, I just, a feature of being a child like myself was that you would be manipulative with adults and with other kids, and you'd try and manoeuvre yourself into a situation that would best suit you. It might be called selfish or self-centred, something like that sort of situation. So as I grew up, I would try and work the situation so that a family friend who was coming around and having a beer, he might talk to my mum, and they would both agree that I could have a shandy or something like that. And then I'd try and squeeze another one and another one, mm-hmm. sort of thing. But basically, I cut my own way in life because I was sick of the control when I was 16, and came to Melbourne, and up until that time when I went out, which was usually a Saturday night, I resented my parents very, very much because they wanted me home at 10 o'clock. And I manipulated an auntie to talk to my parents so I'd get home at 1 o'clock, and I was usually always drunk, drunk, and I loved it.
Talk to me about that.
Well, I'll explain it in a way of being in the pub. In those days, no women were allowed in a public bar, except for the women that were behind we called it the jump, behind the bar serving beer, and they ran serving beer to the guy because the pub just didn't have men at the bar. The actual whole bar area was shoulder to shoulder men, some in singlets and others in suits. And there was just this enormous feeling of camaraderie and brotherhood. And then you'd usually drink in a school and you'd all be talking, well, basically a bunch of rubbish, you know. and it was great because you would explain it as long as you didn't feel, you didn't vomit, you didn't wet your pants or poo your pants or fall over, everything else was in.
Yeah, everything's good. All right, we'll have a little break and we'll come right back.
Hi, my name's Pilar Aguilera and I'm 3CR's chairperson. I'm urging you to become a 3CR subscriber. We need to keep independent, radical, dissenting voices on air. Social change doesn't just happen. We need to nurture it. We desperately need to hear alternative ideas that allow us to organise, build community and change the systems that continue to oppress us and destroy the planet. Put your money where your mouth is. Become a member. Subscribe today.
This is a Living Free Show on 3CR 855 kHz on your AM radio dial and 3CR on digital radio. If you would like to listen to one of our many podcasts, then you can find us on your preferred podcast platform or just Google 3CR Living Free and check out our website. You can also contact us by phone or email. Today, my guest is Brian, and we're chatting about his early experience in life and his great love, his first great love by the sound of it, alcohol with the man in the pub. And the fellowship of that and the camaraderie and the feeling of the alcohol. Now, I'd like you to tell the story, Brian, of how it went after that, you know, how that love affair with alcohol progressed.
Well, the progression of alcohol is that it's absolutely fantastic when you start off because you have two cans and you just feel so much relief and relaxation, and you can talk underwater with a mouthful of marbles, and you really engage in life. And you're going, wow, if this is two cans, what's four cans going to look like, you know? And then four becomes eight, and you build up what we used to call in those days a constitution, and you finish up drinking slabs, and then you move on to a quicker hit, you know, and in comes the whiskey, the gin, and you become a connoisseur on wine and a regular, excuse your language, but bullshit artist.
All right, so the first negative thing you've told me there is the bullshit artistry kicks in. What other shortcomings did emerged in your life?
Well, there's a dependency, of course, and we're taught in life, be it wrong or right, but we do have to procreate to continue the species. So we talk about for a hetero male, getting a wife and having children and that sort of stuff. So what you do is the number one thing without you having any idea at all, because the main thing with alcoholism is that what is the fantasy in your mind is actually reality, and that's called denial. And you live in your head, and there's songs about that. Men at Work come to mind, and Mental Is Anything, and stuff like that. So what you do is you take a hostage. So that becomes a woman who's deeply in love with you and will do anything at all to stop you drinking and to turn you into a responsible man. And she's got a fantasy inside her head what that would look like.
She's got a project. She's got a project.
She's got a project, yes. And it continues and continues and continues until the wheels drop off. And then what happens after that is you'll merge into a raging river of self-pity. And it goes on and on. Only if it was only like this. And why did my dad have to die when I was so young? Why didn't those men pay attention to me? How come nobody loves me, you know?
Okay, I need you to fill in the middle bit of this. I need to know how it gets from great time in the pub with the boys to, you know, this misery with this hostage that you've taken, and then the poor me's. What happened there in between? What is it? Just tell me what happened. How does it get from that to that?
Well, initially, your experience or my experience was dysfunctional. So that's all you know.
But your very early experience, all you know. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then the few drinks that you had and the good feelings you had, you don't know that that's a part of dysfunction. That's normal. So the whole lot of it is normalised. But it's not normal at all. You're living in a fantasy, away from a proper direction, if you like, in life about, in my case, what manhood is, you know, and love and marriage is nothing but hard work, you know, and we've got to be persistent at it. We've got to be responsible with it. We've got to be there when the meal's on the table. We can't disappear for days and then turn up and have the wife ask us, well, where have you been? And you just reply in an almost aggressive way, out. And that means that's the end of the conversation. Yeah. Don't ask again. So just a terrible, terrible existence for a woman. But they won't give up with an alcoholic. They're saviours, you know.
So that's about them, but about you. What about what was your behaviour like? So if you're talking about your story, so what did you do? What did it look like? How did you behave? And how did you feel about the way you behaved? Like my experience is that my self-esteem gets destroyed because I act in a way that I don't, it's outside my moral code to the person I say that I love. And did that happen for you?
I wasn't aware of any self-esteem. I lived in what I was explaining before as the lie of alcoholism, and what that means is constantly bolstering my own ego. And Freud, of course, was the one who had the concept of ego, which was the ego means perception of self. So what the alcoholic is and what this alcoholic is deluded. Deluded in the world of psychiatry means a false belief. So I had a false belief about myself and backed that up constantly. So I was, in a way, a legend in my own mind, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing wrong with my behaviour, because this is the way I said men would act, but this is the way this male was acting. I wasn't a man at all. So it was only later, a lot later, when, keeping in mind, my mum and my stepdad took me to my first meeting of AA when I was 17 up in Ballarat, which I resented and hated them for. And they'd planted a seed, by the way, that AA is there. And how embarrassing would that have been for them as prominent members in a small community, taking a 17-year-old boy to an AA meeting? But the message went straight across the top of my head, and now I say, like, hello, was anything wrong, you know?
So that's the seed was planted. Tell us now what brought you to the next AA meeting.
The next what?
AA meeting.
The next AA meeting was what we call a self-motivated meeting. So that means for the alcoholic that you've had enough of having enough. You get sick of making the alcoholic promise. Gee, I don't know what happened. I must have had too few many VBs, and I sort of mucked up somehow or other. But look, I promise it'll never ever happen again. And alcoholism is known as a disease, and what we're doing by drinking alcohol is flicking an invisible chemical switch in our brain. There's an extra chemical in the synaptic gap, which the initials are THIQ.
I'll just interrupt for the audience. Brian was a psychiatric nurse.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all right for me to say that?
Yeah, it is now.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. That's a fact, yeah.
Go ahead. I just wanted to clarify that.
That's okay. So I've lost my train of thought there. Can you refresh
about
me?
That. Yeah, you were just talking about what brought you to your first AA meeting, your first voluntary AA meeting.
Okay, so I saw my responsibility and the wheels dropped off my first marriage, and my two girls were 3 and 6 months old, and I didn't know, but it brought up about me losing my dad when I was 3 and a half. I didn't know that was going to happen. I had no idea. And it just basically destroyed me. I was full of guilt and shame and trying to be a nurse and be responsible in the society, and I was just failing very badly and drinking more and more and more. So what would a good alcoholic do? Find another hostage. Escape. So sweet. And then the wheels didn't drop off that marriage, but what I did is I worked very, very hard in a modest trade business that I had. I got away from sight nursing and went to a trade business, and then I had almost finished paying for the house, educating the kids and her two boys as well, taught them the trade and did everything that I thought was responsible. Also taught them how to drink and smoke dope as well, which, like, hello, like, not good. And what happened then is that as my drinking increased, my good wife would go out and do her job for the day. I'd be curled up in bed in the fetal position in an alcoholic sweat, knowing that if I got up and had the hair of the dog, the first drink to take away this terrible effect, I'd be as pissed then as I was the night before or more. And if I didn't drink, I was going to go through this hell of withdrawal. And it was damned if I do and damned if I don't. Mm. And I'd get myself up on one elbow when she came home and came into the bedroom with a sort of bewildered look on her face and say, I think I'm an alcoholic. And that went on for 4 years. The last 4 years of my drinking was spent drinking all day and all night. And I'd get up at like 2 or 3 in the morning, a little bit shaky and that, and go to the fridge and do the alcoholic cough. And that consisted of getting a can out of the fridge and ripping the top off the can and going, so no one in the house would fear. No one possibly could know that I'm an alcoholic.
Canny plan you had there. Mm. So and what I'm hearing also is it was either the effects of the drinking, but there's the trauma. The trauma's underneath all that, right? It's come back and hit you in the face.
Mm.
So just before, we'll go to another break in a minute, but just tell us about that first meeting, how you felt when you went in there. Do you remember it? What did you take out of it?
Well, I was drinking, and then really with 4 years of drinking all day and all night, and probably a blood alcohol reading of 0.15, I would say, and it had stopped working, so I used dope on top of that to skyrocket me, quote, Pink Floyd, comfortably numb. And then I thought, this isn't really working. I'm not getting the same effect. And I know what will work would be heroin. And my behaviour was that outrageous, I knew I wouldn't survive heroin. I knew I wouldn't live. So I had no other choice but to adopt my mum and stepfather's advice 27 years earlier. Quick learner, eh?
And that was front and centre in your mind when you felt you were at rock bottom and you were going to have to go to heroin next and you didn't like the sound of that. Parents actually came back to your mind?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So you turned up at the meeting. What did you see there?
No, I didn't turn up at a meeting. I rang AA Central Service Office.
Yep.
And as was my way any time I was on the phone, because I was a businessman in quotes of sorts. So I would get a person's name and their phone number, as much information that I could about them. And then that would just bolster some of my business. So I was just in the habit of doing that. So usually every year of sobriety, I ring Bob and say, it was you that took the call, thanks, and I'm another year sober. And he goes, wow. And then I do the same when he's a year sober. So we have some great contact. Mm-hmm. In that way. And then he advised me of a meeting that was near me and to go and see a person that's passed away, the late Barry Billows, and that he would help me in that meeting. So like a good alcoholic, I didn't go to the meeting. I didn't know I was full of fear. I had no idea. I didn't know what fear was. I had no fear, but I was a frightened little boy.
Mm-hmm.
So the next week I knew that if I didn't get to that meeting, I knew that much about myself, and that's all. If I didn't get to that meeting, I was never going to make it.
Right.
So I got to that meeting. And in that meeting, I met Barry, and he said to me that, come in, have a cup of coffee. Made me a cup of coffee. He said, all you got to do is listen, sit down, have a listen, have a yarn with you later. Do you smoke? Yep. Come outside with the boys and have a fag with the boys, and then come in and sit down when the meeting's ready. So then I heard the sharing, and it was in a church building, and the atmosphere of the church changed. The lighting in the church changed to like a candle light rather than a light. I had a feeling come over me of, I don't know what to say, but complete reassurance, and almost a relaxing feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And just about everyone that spoke, I identified with, which means that I could see myself in what they were saying.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part of AA that works.
The fellowship.
Yeah, well, the fellowship, you can get tangled up with fellowship as meaning friendship. It doesn't mean that. Fellowship is a sense of belonging, and that's the essence of AA. We're not going there for friendship. We're not going there to be saved. We're not going there to be taught. It's a self-help program. It's called tough love. What tough love is a really interesting term, because it's a direct link between compassion and ruthlessness, if you can imagine such a thing.
Yep.
So that's what it is, yep. And that's how the program works.
This is the Living Free Show on 3CR digital radio and live streaming on 3cr.org.au/streaming. Today I'm chatting, or we, Michael and I, are both chatting to Brian about recovery from the effects of alcoholism. And we also want to remind you that we are still in February and it's still subscriber month.
Yeah, so your subscription helps us to stay true to our community values. We're a not-for-profit community radio license holder, and a strong subscriber base is vital to our financial and editorial independence. And the subscription, you can subscribe by going on the website at 3cr.org.au or calling during business hours on 94198377. And the subscriptions are layered. There's a concession subscription for $40. There's a waged. So if you're a worker, then it's $80. If you're a band or organisation, it's $150. And if you're all in solidarity, go $300. So, yeah, we need your subscription, so please come and join us.
Thank you, Michael. Brian, so we're at the point you're now in AA, and you've had what sounds like a spiritual experience early on in your first meeting, and we've only got, we've got 20 minutes left, but if you could tell the story of your recovery in AA all the way up to the point where you decide also to go to Al-Anon. Please.
Yeah, sure. So what happened there was that, we'll start off with another thing about alcoholics. And not only are we in love with alcohol, we're also in love with drama. So that doesn't necessarily stop when the alcoholic decides to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that would involve doing plenty of AA meetings. So life goes on, and what happened was that you become involved in service work. So that might be picking up a tea towel and drying the coffee cups after they're washed, or might be stacking chairs up after the meeting. You start off at a level like that, and it's just called contribution, you know, and you're a part of the crew and that sort of stuff. And then that can develop, and like we've got 3CCR here, we... AA and Al-Anon also have central offices, which the newcomers get mixed up with and call head office, but there are no heads in Al-Anon or AA. It's a very level program, and what AA and Al-Anon are concerned about is alcoholics not having a drink one day at a time. Doesn't matter whether you're like me with 29 years sobriety up, or I'm talking to a newcomer, we're both not having a drink today. It's a very level playing field. Anyway, as a part of this service, I attended a meeting which had about 70 AA members in it, and the service people out the front of the meeting, which was, let's say, half a dozen service people doing their job for AA, someone stood up in the group and stirred up a whole lot of emotion, and this committee that was serving AA was sacked, and it became like a mob attacking these people that were in service. I left that meeting in shock and also laughing, because I thought, my God, if this is Alcoholics Anonymous, there's no problem at all with me getting sober. It's going to work. But as I progressed on with it, I could see my fellow alcoholics, and unbeknownst to me at the time, it included myself, as a bunch of ruthless bastards that didn't really have much idea how other people felt and were a bit removed from empathy, you know. So I thought, oh my God. And I would pray at that time. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And you can hear in my voice the fear that I was experiencing. I can't not go to AA, but I object so strongly to what's occurred, not AA, but to what I've seen occur. So it scared me.
The fear of losing the thing that had helped you so much.
What am I going to do? And then I don't think it was any thinking of my own, but a thought, anyway, popped into my head. Al-Anon. And I thought, that's right, I can learn to live with my fellow alcoholic by going to Al-Anon. I walked into Al-Anon and I explained to them all what had happened, and the people that had been around there for a long while. I was sitting down in the chair and having a share like what I'm doing now. They just leaned over and patted me on the knee, said, it'll be all right, it'll be all right. Just keep coming back, full of love. And I'll share something else from a psychiatric nurse. I was also knew something was wrong with me and was very interested in delving into myself. I've done a heap of work on group therapy, and I know a lot of the models of psychiatry and what famous psychiatrists have written about. None of it helped me. None of it helped me. AA helped me. So I've been involved in a lot of group therapy, and I can tell anyone out there that's living with an alcoholic, you will never ever anywhere in the world hear the degree of expressed feeling and honesty and truth that comes out of an Al-Anon meeting. It is literally incredibly unbelievable and joyous.
That's so interesting. So that you are the first person I know that came into Al-Anon with a problem with, like, 70 alcoholics in our committee. Right, so this gets to the heart of the situation, doesn't it? So now you go to AA meetings and Al-Anon meetings, right?
Correct.
Tell us what you get out of one and what you get out of the other. Is it?
Yep. Well, I've explained to you a disease concept and the invisible chemical switch that's in your head. So what we've got, and this might be difficult for the community to understand, I'm sure it will be, but believe me, it's an incurable family disease. That's what Al-Anon says. What AA says, it's an incurable disease. So there's a slight difference there, but the emphasis on it's incurable, but what it's all about, it can be arrested on a daily basis with regular meetings of either Al-Anon or AA, whatever my problem is. So I go to AA because I'm interested in sharing my experience, my strength, which is 29 years sobriety, and my hope. And my hope is for the newcomer, and just going back to that mob of 70 people, what are we doing? What are we doing for the newcomer? How are we? What's going to be their experience when they come to AA? It's all important. Al-Anon helps me to try and talk to other alcoholics about that, and some are so set in their ways that they haven't an ability to open their mind and talk about it. So we can get alcoholics that just stop drinking, or they partly recover, but the mind isn't completely open and stuff like that. Al-Anon can help in that respect. Because when you hear a newcomer, Al-Anon, usually lady, but they can be men too, sharing about what it's like living with their husband or their wife, what they're experiencing in terms of feelings and the negative feelings they're expressing and what happens to them is just cruel. And to sit in an Al-Anon meeting and listen to what I was like and get that full frontal is quite eye-opening.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, it opens your mind, and fluctuating between the two fellowships allows a more enhanced experience of recovery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite profound what you say. It's a family disease, so it can't actually be understood as existing in one person because it's a disease of relationships.
Mm. Well, what happens there, Anne, is that the alcoholic disappears from the family for two days, or the meal's on the table, he's told by his loving wife, at 7 p.m. and he arrives home at 8 p.m. And stuff like that. That affects the wife. The kids are in bed, usually, at that time, and there's a saying that I'm very, very fond of. All community begins at the table. If only the alcoholic could realise that. And from that, it stretches out into the process that we're going through today, community radio. What we're after is a healthy community. But the kids are affected by this. So we think, oh, hang on, this disease is not only taking out the mind, body and soul of the alcoholic, but it's that insidious and that baffling and that cunning that it's taking out the mind, body and soul of the entire family. Now, this includes the budgie, the dog and the cat as well, and the neighbours. the whole lot goes. Mm-hmm. And you lose more and more and more if you continue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Life is about, or God's will, is mm-hmm. about growth and development.
Mm-hmm. Michael, have you got any special comments over there in the special comments department?
No, that's certainly what Brian's speaking about. It's definitely my experience of, you know, my sponsor's wife is in Al-Anon for a long time, and I hang out with her sponsees, and I have the joy of listening, as exactly as Brian said, that experience of hearing my story from their perspective, and then, you know, because I don't know the damage I do until I hear it out of their mouths. I may not have done all the things that had happened to them, but I certainly was capable of it, and the neglect and the lack of respect and all those things. I don't hear that back. I don't hear about that in Alcoholics Anonymous because there's no one there to tell me. Whereas if I go to Al-Anon, I'm certainly, that was my experience to sit in the very first Al-Anon meeting and take my kids to Alateen. It was, but yeah, I've really. I don't have a question, but I would certainly identify with what Brian said.
Yeah, that was powerful, Brian. Now, just you mentioned, you know, psychiatrists and theoretical psychologists and stuff. So I will say Carl Jung was there at the beginning of the of AA because Bill W., the founder, spoke to Carl Jung. Carl Jung apparently had a... was treating alcoholics, and there was one that he felt was hopeless or something. And he's put it to Bill W. that the thing will need a spiritual dimension in order to arrest the progress of an alcoholic's disease. Can you talk a bit about the spiritual side of the program as it is in your life?
Sure.
Both, and if they're different in both fellowships, mention that too.
So... Who's going to care for you when you don't care for yourself? Where's this love that you crave? Where's it going to come from? So, AA talks about that. Not in depth, but Al-Anon certainly talks about it in depth at a very human level. But in it being so honest and truthful about their feelings, it becomes spiritual. So that you would walk into an AA meeting or an Al-Anon meeting, as different from an online meeting, and you would experience something in the air. It's unexplainable, but you feel safe. And secure. That's a part of spirituality. You feel understood and accepted. And I'm not saying that you understand me or that you accept me. I'm saying I feel understood and accepted. What a relief. I didn't get that with my mom. That wasn't there. You know? I didn't really get it with the guys down the pub because if you start talking about how you're feeling, they'll say, oh, the poor bastard can't handle his piss. So there's no one really that we can share with. And this is what we learn. If we're drinking too much, could we be an alcoholic? If that question is in anyone's mind out there, just go never, ever to one AA meeting. Go to 30 meetings in 30 days and see what you think. But do not go to one meeting and make up your mind. And it's same for the partner of the alcoholic. Go to Al-Anon and go for an amount of time. They advise 6 meetings before, and then make up your mind. I would advise the 30 meetings in 30 days is the recipe, and then make up your mind if it's for you. And it's only after that time that a spiritual journey, not a religious journey, a spiritual journey will occur for you. And what the spiritual journey is is basically you are interested in a change of behaviour, thought and feeling, and that occurs with inside your own self with other people that are interested in the same thing to a greater or lesser degree.
Did you just make that up, or have you learned? Have you heard that before? That was so beautifully put.
No, that's made up.
That's
my experience. How you see it. I'm sharing with you as if I'm in a meeting.
Uh-huh.
But I want to share with the community because you're all so important to me.
Yeah.
Out there, if there is any alcoholism there, please come and be with me.
Mm-hmm. Because the kind of wisdom that you hear on this show and every episode, I think we hear great wisdom, don't we, Michael?
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're hearing in spades in the meetings as well.
Yeah, people speak from the heart. Yep. So they're not thinking about it before they've done it. The things come out of people's mouths that they didn't know they thought or that they felt. And you see it in their eyes. They say stuff that they didn't know was in there.
They didn't know what they were going to say.
They go, oh, that's actually how I feel.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is profound, and it is sometimes I think what is spiritual, and I think, well, it's basically the invisible forces that are working on us that we don't fully understand, and it is love, and it's truth, and beauty, and acceptance, and understanding, and we just feel better in the presence of all that, don't we? Yep.
Absolutely.
Balanwa's not coming in today. Uh-huh. They're at a pre-record, so we've got a little bit longer. You have probably said all you need to say, Brian, but if either of you, really, anything else that you'd like to say today?
No, really, thank you. Thanks to Brian for sharing his experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to come across someone who's been to, you know, sitting in both fellowships.
Yeah.
You might think a little bit more about spirituality. Let's have some fun with it and call it the fourth dimension. And you would say, well, what could the fourth dimension be? So we're going to name it spirituality, say.
Mm-hmm.
So what's one-dimensional? One-dimensional is reading a book. AA and Al-Anon also have online meetings. An online meeting would be two-dimensional. But here, sitting with you three and it's not the three, but face-to-face is three-dimensional. And what we're aiming...
Sorry for that abrupt ending. We've started a bit late, so we didn't get the whole interview there. If you're concerned about drinking in a relative or friend and would like to find out more about Al-Anon, you can contact them on 1-300-252-666 or go to alanon.org.au. If you are concerned about your own drinking, you can contact Alcoholics Anonymous on 1-300-222-222 or go online at aa.org.au. If the content in the segment you just listened to has raised questions or caused distress to you, please call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or visit lifeline.org.au. Thank you to Brian for sharing his story with us. Thank you to Michael for coming and joining me today in the studio. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and I hope you enjoy this podcast.
Is drinking costing you more than money? Alcoholics Anonymous provides a free and anonymous recovery service to anyone who wants to call it quits. Join millions of other alcoholics worldwide and take your first brave steps towards a new beginning. There are thousands of AA meetings happening every week across Australia. If you'd like to find your closest meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous or have any questions regarding this tried and tested treatment for alcoholism, call 1-300-AA-AA-AA. That's 1-300-222-222. Or visit aa.org.au.
This community service announcement is sponsored by Alcoholics Anonymous.
You you've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.